The Whole Health Cure with Dr. Sharon Berquist, the podcast that brings you inspiration and skills for living a healthy and fulfilled life.
Welcome to the Whole Health Cure podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist. On this podcast, we explore the science and provide inspiration and skills for living your happiest, most fulfilling, and healthiest life. Today's topic is going to be tips to avoid fake coronavirus news and how to find answers to your coronavirus questions. And I'm delighted to be joined by Senior Medical Director at WebMD, Dr. Arifa Kasabor. Arifa is a board-certified internal medicine doctor who's passionate about health literacy and committed to raising awareness of health topics that are currently under the radar and affect vulnerable communities. Her projects focus on empowering individuals and communities to improve their health through collaborations, including advocacy, research, and education. A senior medical director at WebMD, Kasabor and the medical team ensure all content across WebMD is not only correct and current, but also easy to understand and useful. She oversees a national network of doctors that reviews content across the site and works with editorial teams on strategy and content development, covering articles, videos, mobile applications, and tools. Dr. Kasabor sees patients and serves on board of directors at the Clarkston Community Health Center. This rapidly growing nonprofit clinic provides healthcare to underinsured and uninsured individuals, many of whom are recent immigrants. Involved with medical education and alumni engagement, Dr. Kasabor serves on the Emory School of Medicine Alumni Board and Rollin School of Public Health Community Advisory Board. Always learning, Dr. Kasabor is pursuing board certification in lifestyle medicine. This is an evidence-based approach to prevent and treat disease with changes in diet, exercise, and other lifestyle modifications. Arifa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Sharon.
I'm so excited to talk to you about, health literacy and health news, because I think like no other time, there's been so much attention on health news, specifically around coronavirus. I imagine you and your colleagues are probably flooded trying to get information out to the public fairly rapidly. Let me start by asking you, if a person wants to learn more about the virus, it's so natural to go to the web and just Google. What are ways that a person can get a sense if they're getting a good website or a reliable source? And the corollary is, what are good ways to spot fake news?
Sure, that's an important question because, like you said, the internet is flooded with information about COVID-19. Every angle is being covered right now because the pandemic is impacting every aspect of our life, from work and social to our health. One thing to be careful about is the information that's coming on your social feed and your news feed, because that can be sources that are not vetted. So being proactive about going to sites in particular that you know you can trust is very important, as opposed to clicking on what comes through the feed. And when you're looking for sites to go to for medical and health information, the national and international health organizations are really the place to start. So the CDC and the World Health Organization, for example, are ideal sites that have information and easy to understand formats that give good tips on what you can do at home. Also, multiple academic institutions are setting up information sites that you can trust, and your medical organizations if you have a particular illness. That's a great place to start. So if you have multiple sclerosis or diabetes, you can go to those national organizations and see what kind of data they're analyzing, and from that, what recommendations are they making for you and other people like yourself with an illness.
And so that's great advice. It's good to make that distinction between social media and taking a more proactive approach to getting on the internet and doing a search. And Arifa, when a person goes to the internet to get their information, Jenny, you mentioned the Centers for Disease Control and World Health Organization, which have both been leading a lot of the effort towards increasing our knowledge. There are also websites that take information from these organizations and reference that. And so they're really not a primary person that's creating that information, but a secondary source. Do you have any thoughts on the reliability of the sites that reference the primary sources?
Absolutely. I work for WebMD and I'm very proud of the content that we create, and we'd be one of those organizations that you're referencing. So it is very important when you're looking at other websites to vet them properly. No, it's okay to go to these other sites like news sites and health and medical sites, because they may be going that extra step to not only help you understand recommendations on how to live your life and medical advice. They may be explaining information in a different format that's easier for you to take in and understand. They're trained to take those recommendations and put them in slideshows, in videos, in tools that you can go through and answer questions. All of that takes an incredible skill set and then a few more steps. So you're welcome to do that. And I would encourage that. Tricks to really look at these secondary sites to know what's vetted or not. When you're looking at the site, check and see if there's a date of when the content had been looked at. And that's critical with COVID-19 content right now. So for example, with face masks, if you're looking at an article that was written a few weeks ago, they may be telling you that you don't need a face mask and the face masks are only for healthcare providers and people working in hospitals and clinics. Of course, that data has and data and recommendations have changed. Now everyone needs to wear a face mask when they're out. So updated information will let you know that you've got the most recent advice and data to evaluate. Another thing is to look for, is there an author listed? And that's an indication of whether there's pride in that document that was created. Someone's willing to say, hey, I'm the one that wrote this. And you can look at the author's bio and just double check. Do they have the education and the expertise and the experience to say what they're saying? Another thing you can check for is for sources to be listed. And that's critical. If they're making a recommendation that you should do this, they should also let you know where they're getting that recommendation from. And the fourth thing I would add is when you're looking at a site, go to the About section and check and see who is this organization supposed to be representing and who is their intended audience. Are they here with a mission to educate and empower others? Or maybe are they representing a group that's selling something or has an agenda, whether it's sales, economic, or even political?
Now, that's really good advice. So again, the four things are to look at the date, look at the author, the sources, and the About section to learn about the mission of the organization. And so if a person is doing a search, are there ways to pick the right keywords? Like, is there a good way to do a search on the internet versus a not so effective way?
So right now with COVID-19, you may have a whole series of questions, right? I compare it to looking at whether you can get the test, whether, you know, for like testing for COVID-19. Do you need the test? Where would you get the test? How would you pay for the test? What are the test results going to mean for you? There's really quite a few different angles to testing. So when you're doing your search, you want to go in and ask that specific question. You can limit the search under Google search so that they're giving you information that's been published in the last 1 week, last 1 month, so that you can get the newest information. You can also limit by geography. So if it's about where to get tested, you can limit it to your geographic location and then focus in on organizations that, again, you can trust. So maybe it's with testing, it's your local Department of Public Health.
So that's very helpful to be able to limit to the location and the time period. And when you do that, do you type that into the search field, or are there certain clicks that you can do that filter the search?
There is a bar underneath the Google search that has a few options, and there's images and shopping, and all the way to the right-hand side are more tools, and you can click on that and it'll open up some more options in terms of timing of the search and whether you want to be in a regular Google search or even in Google Scholar, which is just going to give you like medical reference articles. And that's not necessarily going to be relevant to finding a testing location, but it might give you research articles about what testing is appropriate or not. Mm-hmm. If you're digging down that hole, really trying to get into the literature yourself.
Right. And I want to go back to something you said earlier, which I think is such an important point to be made about secondary sources. It ties to what you had mentioned about all the great work that WebMD does, taking information and putting it in a way that's easy to understand, whether it's through slides, whether it's just explaining it in a way that someone who isn't in the field of healthcare can understand it and walk away not confused by the terminology. And it makes me think of the topic of health literacy in a general term, not just as it relates to COVID-19, but in a way that people can use the internet for their general health. The information, can you tell me a little bit about the process that goes into creating content that is easy to understand? It's in some ways, when you read the final product, it's great. You can read it and get through it and walk away with great information, but there's a lot that goes into that, that end product. Can you talk a little bit about that process?
Oh, I'd love to. This is my favorite work. I really enjoy the whole process. At WebMD, we'll have basically brainstorm sessions and come up with ideas, and then we'll discuss. And this will be a team of people with all different training strengths. So you might have a video editor, a journalist, a person specialized in Google search, quite a few different areas. Plus, of course, someone like myself, who's a physician, trained in the medical piece of all of this. And we'll come up with ideas in terms of addressing a topic like COVID-19. What are people searching for on the internet? So what are they actually asking for? What's the best way to inform them about that? Who are the right people for us to go research this topic? Who's actually going to write the article? And then as these articles get formed, when it comes to me, it is actually referenced line by line. So the reader doesn't see that, but every single number, every single statistic, every idea is actually referenced back to a primary source, whether it's an actual journal article coming out of China or a consensus statement by a medical organization or a medical expert who is treating patients or researching the disease. All of that is written out, and then we will go through and edit it along with other editors that are in the process, but I'm the medical piece of it, and make sure that everything's covered that needs to be covered, that everything's accurate, everything's up to date, that the flow of the article makes sense, that it's balanced and covers both sides of an argument and doesn't overstate facts or understate them. So we'll go through all of that. It's multiple back and forths to get an article ready to go. And then It'll finally go to copy edit where all the grammar and those last touches are put on it, and it'll get published. And then include, let's say you see images with an article. We will actually, every image is medically vetted. So if you see a device that's maybe for something related to dermatology, we'll make sure you're actually seeing the correct device. Or if it's, I recently had to do something with mammograms, and we were trying to get make sure we had the most appropriate mammogram testing device. So yeah, so we check all of that, and all of that's going on behind the scenes. Now, not every organization is doing that. So that's where you really have to understand that background to know whether you can trust someone else's plain language and interpretation of the content.
Hey, you know, it's amazing how much work goes into a final product that, you know, all happens behind the scenes. And so thank you for sharing that. And, you know, it makes me also think about, you know, how challenging it can be to understand medical information, because, you know, a person can, you know, have a PhD in a topic and still not be familiar with some of the terminology as it pertains to, let's say, antibody testing, which right now is a big question. So when you do all this work, you're trying to get it to a point that's reader friendly. Can you talk more about what health literacy is and why it's important that you do the work that you're doing?
Many people just kind of assume that we're supposed to understand all this medical terminology. And I compare it to financial literacy. And we've talked about this before. You could have a PhD in economics. It doesn't mean you know how to get a mortgage, and you don't know, and it doesn't mean you know how to budget, you know, what kind of house to buy and how you're going to manage making that mortgage month to month for the next 30 years. So it's the same for healthcare. And it is important that we recognize that we are supposed to be able to ask the questions, and we aren't supposed to know the answers right off the bat. And so whether it's actually understanding what the illness is versus understanding what the treatment options are, relating that back to what's relevant to you as a person, what's going to make sense, and then kind of saying, okay, I have a couple of options here. I can do nothing. I can follow my doctor's recommendations, whether they're conservative or aggressive. I can, you know, focus on lifestyle measures. I can quit smoking, for example, or focus on nutrition or exercise. Try something complementary in the complementary arena to supplement what my doctor's recommending, or, you know, just go all out and try something alternative that's not proven and that maybe my doctor wouldn't even approve and could potentially be harmful. So it's interesting really breaking that down and then utilizing the internet and to kind of look up information and take it in to sort through these thoughts that you're having through your head and figure out what your next steps are going to be, and then find the right person to help you, whether that's your doctor to really give you advice on how to manage your care, or maybe it's your doctor's office manager that's going to help you figure out how to pay for all this and how to, or someone else that maybe in therapy, right? So mental health, physical therapy, all the allied health. There's so many avenues where you can get medical and health advice that's beyond even, you know, your doctor alone. So understanding what those options are, the internet and health literacy can really be helpful getting you there. And then as you're talking to these different people, filling out the forms correctly, following up on calls and communicating with them.
Yeah, no, a lot of steps go into that. And there's, you know, as you point out, that a person can be really savvy in one area, but it doesn't necessarily extrapolate to other, you know, types of information. When, you know, a person tries to use the internet as an adjunct to their physician's care, are there times where it can actually work against them? You know, I've had patients kind of tease that they're always three clicks away from cancer, and some of the searches that they've done have made them really anxious and worried that their symptom, you know, could be a sign of something serious, such as cancer. Are there ways that, or topics that are good to search versus, you know, symptoms that may take people down a path where they're probably better off not using the internet for their health information?
Absolutely. There's a, and I think this applies to the internet in general, beyond searching for health information. There's a limit to how much time any of us need to be on the internet searching information, trying to process information. We really need to get in there with our question, get the information, and then move away from that laptop and decide, how is this going to impact my life? And let me get moving on it. And who do I speak to in person to really double check what I think I should do, or what my understanding of a topic is. And then again, move into the action phase of applying it to your daily life. So I do think that you don't need to understand your condition completely before you go to see the doctor, whether it's diabetes or heart disease or COVID-19 or you know, something simple like stubbing your toe or tennis elbow. The internet can be a way to give you some quick ideas, understand what emergency symptoms are to make sure you don't have them, understand what might be flags that, hey, this is something I do need to go into the doctor, then get to the doctor, really utilize them as the main person that, you know, you trust with your health. Do that back and forth. Ideally have a second person there to take notes so that the questions that you come into the office with actually get answered. And that anything that comes up during the office visit, which, you know, they're usually so fast, you almost need someone else to document everything and take notes so that when you leave and you're processing what that happened during that 15 minutes, and that's an important step, to take time to process the doctor's office visit. You can say, hey, they mentioned this term, let me look it up. What do they mean by watchful waiting? I've heard that before. Let me check. And really use that to supplement and reinforce their relationship with their doctor and their other healthcare providers, whoever they may be, you know, in terms of therapists. It's really not meant at all to take the place of these people. It's to really help that. And again, limiting is important. I mean, especially with COVID-19 right now, the news cycle is 24 hours. I mean, I actually wrote a blog that'll probably be published later today. And I'm telling people, you know, when you're reading the news about COVID, do it early in the day for a short period. Don't look again, so that your sleep doesn't get disturbed. And even when your social feed, as people are coming in with a 50 million different ways of making masks and how they're, you know, donating to massive groups, you know, it is wonderful what everyone's doing. Only do what you can do. And everybody's situation is different. So it's really a matter of shutting off the social media at some point and saying, hey, everybody out there is showing their best self. No one's showing their dark moments and their stressed moments. And, you know, I'm going to take a break and enjoy my real time.
Right. Now, it's good to point out that there's a limit to even good information. And, you know, you had mentioned, you know, using the internet as a supplement, as an adjunct to going to your doctor's office. And, you know, a lot of times when my patients do internet searches and they want to tell me, you know, what, quote, Dr. Google, you know, and quote, has told them, they do it in this apologetic way. And they, you know, preface it saying, oh, you must hate when patients do this, but when I searched it, this came up. And they almost preface it in the way that the assumption is that most physicians, you know, would eye roll at the thought of a patient going to the internet. Do you think that is a, you know, a common way that doctors perceive it? Do you think that doctors would welcome it? And should patients feel really empowered to do that?
I'm not sure exactly where physicians are with the internet as a health source, like in general, but I do feel it is something that's here and it's going to stay, and that it is empowering for patients to be able to look up what information may supplement their conversation with the doctor. And in, I would ideally like doctors to really think of this as such a great advantage. They only have 15 minutes with the patient. If they can be proactive about saying, hey, you know, go to these three sites to really learn a little more if you want, and this will help you understand your illness better, and we can talk more at our next visit. Or it doesn't have to be just health information in terms of understanding a condition. It could be, hey, you know, we've talked about like getting you moving around more and exercising, and I know it's tough for you to leave your house with your difficulties walking, for example. Here are some sites that will might help you with exercise at home. And here are sites that will connect you with others with your condition. You know, you may not be there right now, but if you do want to talk to others, this is a site that's vetted, and I think it's worth trying out. I mean, I think there's just so many opportunities to guide our patients and to really get them at the right place. So I would encourage that.
Yeah, and I completely agree. I mean, I personally love the empowerment, because I think that patients, you know, really play such a big role in their own healing and in, you know, treating their own disease. And the more knowledge that they have, which often is more than what we can do in short office visits, I think the better that, you know, the outcome for them. So I think, as you point out, there's so many good resources, and physicians, you know, can help people by providing the better websites and at least writing out a diagnosis so that, you know, people can spell it when they type it into their search.
Yes. Simple. We're talking simple steps here.
I know. It's, you know, a lot of Latin words that just spelling them out in itself is something helpful that can at least get people started on the right track. What other things do you think consumers should be aware of when they use the web for their source of medical information?
One thing that's coming up a lot right now with COVID-19 is there's research that's going on in the hospital setting, and people are trying to figure out what's relevant to them at home. So with treatment protocols, for example, and people, you know, you'll see one site where, you know, they're using, you know, they're saying they're using the medications in-house in clinical trials. That doesn't necessarily correlate with people trying to take these medications at home. So I think it's very important to understand that context is critical with what you're reading in the news and then what you can actually utilize at home. Another place that comes up, this is sort of just a fun topic that's been in the news, well, not necessarily fun, but it's an interesting topic that's in the news, are the pet, are issues with pets and COVID-19. So it's fascinating reading the stories of what's happening with animals around the globe. I mean, it's thankfully, you know, most of the big cats, like for example, at the New York Zoo, and then in Asia, they are not suffering from the illness, but they are testing positive. Now, I am following those stories in the big national news networks and very interested in it. But that doesn't correspond with what happens with my pets at home. And so there are a lot of questions, you know, what translates to the cats at home and your dogs at home. So sort of splitting those two and knowing that for pet care, what I need to do is to go to the CDC or go to the American Veterinaries Association and see what their data is and look at what date they last updated their content. That's really important. And then, you know, for example, and we've talked about this already on the podcast, understanding who's actually writing the material and reading the material. We have pet content on WebMD. I am not reviewing the pet content on WebMD. We have veterinarians that come through and actually do that so that you can look at, you know, you can read the information and know that this is valid for, you know, my animals at home.
I'm so glad, Arva, that you brought up this issue of making sure that the information fits your context and pertains to you, because, you know, we're also getting similar requests and questions around treatments for COVID-19 in specific. And as you point out, the more experimental treatments for sick people in a hospital setting may not apply to people who hardly have symptoms and are comfortable at home with the illness. That's a really good point. And I think applying that to a lot of the evolving information, including the clinical trials and the available testing, especially the antibody testing, that kind of paying attention to what's really just at the cusp and maybe still in clinical or trial phase where it's still being researched versus something that is ready to be used widespread. It's a really important point. I think sometimes that's the hardest part, to differentiate when you're reading this information, because it's something that isn't readily obvious or intuitive, but something that's worth reiterating as an important distinction.
There's a lot of fine reading to be done. One term that's being thrown around a lot is FDA approved. And then when you actually read what they're discussing, there's an FDA authorization for emergency use. It does not mean that the drug is FDA approved for use the way we would traditionally use that terminology before COVID-19. And that sort of changes how you look at something completely. It's only authorized to be used in an emergency, you know, situation because of we just don't know so much about COVID-19. It does not mean that the FDA has vetted the drug and thinks it works. So that's something I would like our audience to really be aware of.
Yeah, it's a really good point, and we're getting a lot of similar questions as well, trying to explain why we can't make some of, you know, the technologies, even some that we have developed in our institution, yet available to others. It's really in the best interest of people, not because we don't want to or don't have enough of the capability, but it's just knowing that when it's still in this, you know, authorized but not approved phase, that we're still trying to learn a lot about the testing. I think that, you know, just that distinction is really helpful to understand why certain delays happen in people getting some of the testing that they would like to get done.
Another area I see where sort of distinguishing what kind of content you're actually looking for, what your question is with face masks. So I'm having, just my neighbors and my friends and family asking, you know, what mask do I need now that they're telling me, and, you know, what exactly do I need? And so there's some great do-it-yourself, you know, websites where people are popping up, giving the information of how to do it. What I'd recommend is look at an authorized source. Like the CDC actually has instructions on how to make a face mask, and they have a couple of versions. Some are as simple as the bandana that you fold and then put over your face, and others are the kind that are sewn with, you know, proper sewing machine and have a space for a filter to be added. So for something as simple as that, you want to go to those sites or your local hospital if you want to donate supplies. I know for you guys, I've told people to go to the Emory site because they actually have patterns that you can print and cut out and create the masks. So you can learn from that, you know, what is done, and then use common sense when you're watching all the fun sort of quick videos on YouTube and coming through your social feed on hacks to see what hack actually makes your work easier but doesn't compromise quality, and understand, you know, sort of what the quality that you can expect from a face mask that's for the public is, you know, really it's not going to protect you the way the hospital mask and N95 would in the hospital, but it is still worth wearing, and there's a lot of things you can do to make it as effective as possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, those are really good points. Well, Arfa, I want to thank you for your time, and really also thank you for all the work that you and WebMD put into taking content and making it in a way that's so easy to understand, where people can get such quick information and, you know, walk away feeling that they really understand the topic better. So thank you for all the work that you do. Is there anything you want to add?
No, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate being able to talk about this topic in terms of health literacy and how we can apply it with COVID-19 right now. I appreciate the time to do that.
Well, thank you. Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by Emory Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness. For more information about wellness assessments, classes, and other resources, please visit our website, emoryhealthcare.org/livewell. This material is copyrighted by Emory University.